जय माँ। वी आर ऑन चैप्टर 11 ऑफ एसेज ऑन द गीता टाइटल वर्क्स एंड सैक्रिफाइस एंड फ्रॉम हियर बेसिकली वी सी द बिगिनिंग ऑफ चैप्टर 3 ऑफ द गीता विच इज कर्म योग। सो व्हाट वी हैव फिनिश्ड टिल नाउ टिल चैप्टर 10 इज बेसिकली सांख्य एंड सांख्य इज अ डिसिप्लिन which is the first step required, even in life, in everything. It has very practical implications. What it means is that our intelligence can get carried away by emotions, anger, impulses, fear. And when it is thus carried away by all this storm of passions, desires, ego, then it becomes clouded. So it's known as the clouded state of intelligence. And when the intelligence is clouded, it starts making blunders because it forgets who we are, why we are here. We become that passion, we become that anger, we become that ambition. And that clouded state is not conducive to any person who wants to take the ascent to higher paths. So first thing is to teach and train this intellect to step back and then to turn inward and upward. So its practical important means, supposing there is a time of confusion. So what do? People normally start playing with cell phone, calling this, calling that. What is important is to call upon the divine, wait for the grace, then you act. We have to act, but at least to learn to draw back from situations, circumstances. Not only situations, circumstances, our emotional, passionate, desire-burdened, ego-laden evaluation of them. Because if we do that, we will not be able to make the right decision. Even if it appears right decision, because it may bring us instant success. But this will be a wrong decision from the deeper standpoint, because it will lead to our losing the path and falling. Pranashyati, as the Gita says. We suffer a fall. So the first thing in Buddhi Yoga or Sankhya Yoga is to learn to take this intelligence out. Because it's a great gift to human beings. In human beings, intelligence has this capacity of separating itself from the action and observing it. Animals don't have that freedom. So, in animals, the intelligence acts mechanically, based on instinct. If you step on a snake or a tiger, you can't even step, the snake will bite you. It's not going to step back and see the consequences. Though sometimes, I just read a very interesting story the other day about a crocodile in Padmanabh temple in Kerala. This crocodile is a vegetarian crocodile, the only vegetarian crocodile in the world. And this crocodile suddenly appeared, and when it died 2022, another crocodile came after 1 year and took its place. And nobody knows from where it came. And this crocodile, I've actually seen the video, the priest feeds with his own hand rice and all the prasadam. And it never harms anyone, doesn't even eat the fish in the pond. But this is, of course, very rare and exceptional. otherwise, of course, crocodile is the vahana of Ganga. It's very rare. But usually, generally speaking, animals are bound by their nature. They can't self-regulate their activity. So they operate much like the AI, whatever has been fed into it. Or worse still, like our smartphone, which autocorrects B into beautiful. And if you write great, I don't need to say what word will come next. So that's a very mechanical way. But human beings can step back, look at their action, look at what they are going to do, look at their will, feelings, thoughts, and thereby rectify. But the Gita right now is not speaking of rectification. That, in fact, it doesn't speak. Frankly speaking, only Sri Aurobindo speaks about it. But it can become a sakshi, a witness. And yet nature is unfolding itself. And yet by withdrawing itself from consent to certain activities, it can become free. It's a practice with which we can become free. And if one can achieve this state, that itself is regarded as something great. So for that, one has to practice equanimity. Because again and again, if we are impelled or disturbed by success and failure, then again the same process will happen. intelligence clouded by ambition. Ambition says do anything because you want to achieve success. And if you do that, over a period of time, your immediate success will pave the way to an eventual failure. That's how yoga looks at life. That instant success leading to eventual failure. So this is what we have read so far. But a question arises that, well, if we withdraw our intelligence from activity and look at it dispassionately. So if we really take a look, we will see that almost all of our activity, almost, not all, certainly, is impelled by some sort of desire or other. The desire may be gross. Want money or some, you know, advantages, some perks. Or it could be very subtle. Some position, name, fame. Or even it could be still subtler. I want to be recognized as a yogi, a sadhak, an Aurovillian who is an elite, or an ashramite who is an elite. So desires can take very, very subtle forms. Ego can take very subtle forms. They don't leave us so easily. Even a person who is apparently being a martyr for the family may develop this ego that I am a martyr. Something great. So ego can take many forms. So seeing this, the natural tendency, especially in quietistic disciplines, is why act at all? If one looks at action, you see that it is caught in a web of desire, spinning action, result, action, result. That's why it is called as a bondage. So Sri Krishna says that if you act like this, you will be bound. It's a cause of bondage. Therefore, stand back, learn to recover your intelligence, which is clouded. Recover the jnana. So Arjuna is confused. He says, you are asking me to step back, stand back from action. But you are telling me to act in this ghor karma, not just ordinary work, but a work which is of a deadly kind. So tell me one thing. That's what we read, and chapter 3 starts with this. In the Gita, chapter 3 begins like that. Arjun says, again I am confused. That you are talking about jnana and the jnani state, the whole rivers can enter into that ocean, he is undisturbed, unperturbed. So why would such a person act at all? What need he has? Of course, not all action is because of that, the thirst for knowledge for which people need. It's not impelled by desire. But still, largely, almost we may say 80 to 90% of human action. Equally, there are some actions which are mechanical. They're not impelled by desire. One wakes up in the morning, elimination, food, hunger, normal. But majority of action is impelled by desire. He says, why should one act at all? So here starts the gospel of karma. Because Sri Krishna is emphasizing on karma. So from there start the secret of the karma yoga, which Sri Aurobindo will take it through the next 4 or 5 chapters. He develops it. And why he has to develop it? Partly because, well, as I keep saying, Gita is written or spoken in a hurry. Arjun is right in the middle of the battlefield and Sri Krishna has to just ensure that this fellow fights the war because it's needed for the sake of dharma, for the sake of triumph of truth. And there is no time to elaborate upon, he already elaborates so that it can be of good to all, but he has no time to elaborate on all the sides of this doctrine. And Arjun asks him later on, oh, those wonderful words that you spoke, can you speak them again after the war, everything? He says, what, you forgot them? He rebukes him. Then he, of course, then he speaks in the courtyard of Yudhishthir. So that's known as the second Gita. But it doesn't have that kind of power-packed punches. Here, Sri Krishna is like, do it. That's why. Here is the background. Here is the fundamental truths. Therefore, thou must act. Now, Sri Aurobindo understands our human nature. We are living in a different age. We are highly mentalized. So he needs to clarify everything. And the first need to clarify is the terms that are used in yoga. So this is a, for instance, many people understand even today yoga is a set of physical exercises or just mental exercises. And when the mother says that you may do Hatha yoga and Raja yoga discipline, yet you are not on the spiritual path. So people find it very difficult to understand that you are practicing Raja yoga and you are practicing Hatha yoga, yet you are not practicing spirituality. But if you look at the Gita closely, we'll understand why she is saying that. So there is always this problem of understanding terms in our own language. Divine means one thing by love, and we understand quite another thing by love. So first he clarifies what are works. Because what is Arjun saying? Arjun is saying, I am not going to act. Better that I don't act. Why are you inspiring me to act? When you have yourself told me, action is bondage and knowledge is superior. Then he has to explain what are works. So he starts by explaining that simply not engaging outwardly in action is not freedom from action. First thing that we need to understand. Why? Because the senses have been restrained, but the mind is roving around the objects of the senses. Which means, if I bow down before people and say, you are such a nice person, so happy to meet you, but in my mind, I am thinking, when will this fellow go? Then I am engaging in what the Gita calls as mithyachar. Mithyachar is a term the Gita uses. He says, you may act as if outwardly you are a sannyasi. Of course, Sri Aurobindo elaborates. He says, mithyachar, one way is to understand is hypocrite. So hypocrisy is nowadays not acceptable. Younger generation doesn't like, because hypocrisy is really, because you are deceiving actually. Hypocrisy is like deception. But he says somebody may be genuinely practicing. For instance, somebody is restraining the senses, really doing it. But he is restraining it forcefully. But his mind is still caught into that web. So he says, it's not, he's not a hypocrite in that sense, because poor fellow is actually trying. But he is deluded. Sri Aurobindo uses the word that mithyachar here would mean. So mithyachar would mean two things. One, somebody who is not indulging, controlling, restraining the senses by either will or because of social pressure. A lot of people apparently do behave in a certain way out of social pressure. But they can be terrible people in their mind or when they are alone. So that of course is hypocrisy, mithyachar, which doesn't bear neither worldly fruits nor other worldly fruits. But at the same time, there are people who genuinely restrain their senses for whatever reason, but their mind is dwelling constantly upon it. They are unable to control the mind. So he says, first thing, you are saying that you will not fight the battle. All right. You think that you will not be bound because you are not engaging in the ghore karma. But sitting on the fence, you will be analyzing, getting angry. See, this is depicted very beautifully in Iliad. So Achilles says, I am not going to fight the war. Of course, his reasons are very personal, because the girl he loved has been taken away by King Agamemnon. So he says, I am not going to fight for you. And if Achilles doesn't fight, they are not sure whether they'll win or not. So people try to counsel him that this war is much greater than, you know, the king. But he is angry. And then his nephew gets killed. By mistake, they think he is Achilles, because he is very annoyed that why my uncle is not fighting. And he takes his armor, takes his shield, takes and goes into the fight. And everybody thinks that he is Achilles, Hector, a great warrior. And there is a fight, and the nephew gets killed. Then Achilles plunges into the war, very angry at that whole thing. So Sri Aurobindo says that, Shri Krishna says, what will happen, Arjun? You will not fight. First he has told, people will, it will be apakirti, which is something for the Aryan ideal. It was something very, you losing your prestige, your honor, is as good as dying. That was the great Aryan ideal. So he says, there will be apakirti. Second reason he gives, that people will follow your path. So everybody in the face of difficulty and danger will want to run away. That's not the path example you should set. Why? Because you are a Shrestha. And whatever the Shrestha do, that everybody does. And then Sri Krishna gives very sweetly, I find this sentence very sweet and very powerful. He gives his own example. He says, you see, Arjun, there is nothing in this world for which I need to act. One of those places where he has started giving him hint that who is he? Who is speaking here? He says, there is no need for me to act. And yet, I act. If I don't act, there will be confusion in the minds of people. And second, if I don't act, the entire wheel of dharma that will begin to collapse. So I act to carry the march of humanity together. Meaning thereby, action is not just for personal reasons. There is an action which can be completely selfless, which is what is unfortunately misinterpreted as for the sake of duty. Duty is also a selfish concept. It's a, you know, when you say duty for the family, you are only enlarging the scope of your selfishness. That's all. It's okay, better than being entirely selfish. But first step is that we have to learn that we need to act in this world, not acting outwardly, but thinking, feeling, getting annoyed. As the mother says, if you are full of ill will, it's an action. At one place she says, many people pass on their ill will. And she says, even there is a kind of goodwill which is an ignorant, ignorant goodwill does as much harm as an ill will. So what is ignorant goodwill when people see you and say, oh, what happened to you? You have lost some weight. Are you suffering from some serious illnesses? Concern. But what you have done, you have injected the poison of fear. And we do it all the time. Sometimes we don't say it, but we are thinking. Doctors very often, prognostication. So the entire world of thought, feeling, will, impulse, passion is part of the action that the Gita speaks of. By restraining outwardly, but letting the mind dwell on the objects. The senses are not dwelling on the object, but the mind is dwelling on the object. There are people I have seen, for instance, people who don't eat outwardly. In Indian families, you will see on fasting days. So how much they think about food, night, what food is going to come, what prasad is going to come. I have seen even in Dubai, same thing, Ramjan. So morning they will eat and night. And it will be like a real feast, all different kinds of meat. Now that's mithyachar, because you are not really doing what you profess to do. You are outwardly restraining, but inwardly dwelling. And that, yes, can cause, even psychologically I may add, that is what repression is about, and it can really lead to serious imbalances. There are people who lose their balance. That's why people don't understand a yogi's action. So they say, oh, if you don't, if you restrain yourself, you repress your desires, they will come up in a different way. Yes, that is only if you repress it in action, but indulge in the mind. That is dangerous. But Sri Krishna advises, you must master the senses by the mind, not by just simply outwardly you are restraining. So by the mind means, mind has to get engaged and it has to say, no, this is not the thing to be done. How will the mind master the senses? Mind has to be mastered by the buddhi. Buddhi will tell, see, this is not how, because it has long-term consequences, whatever way. This is not my path, this is not my goal, and therefore the mind, when it obeys the buddhi and thereby impacts the senses, it's a suppression, or, you know, leads to rejection, which is the yogic method. There are no imbalances there, because then you are cleaning your inner room. But if you fill the inner room with filth and only restrain outside, then that is dangerous. Of course, it's dangerous. And how will the buddhi act this way? Only when the buddhi is fixed in the Lord. So this is the whole hierarchy, that when the buddhi takes it, why will otherwise, what will be the basis of action? So that's why we have this two paradigms. One is that man should be good. Shubhindu challenges this in Ishavasya Upanishad, that man should be good. So he says, if you say all is simply desire and built out of, you know, all that, there is no God in this world, there is no divine, then why should I be good? You have taken away from buddhi the plank, the reason. Buddhi wants a reason. Why should we be good if all is survival of the fittest? See how dangerous this doctrine has been. I mean, I'm not even going into its dynamics and how false it can be. So it is as simple as that. But if you say that there is a higher purpose, there is something greater than me, then it will make sense that yes, buddhi must be fixed in the divine, and therefore it impels the mind to take the right choices, the mind impels the senses, and then you choose the right thing. So this is how he explains that works is not physically abstaining. Okay, fine, this is fine, it's understood. But then why would you still act? That question still remains. So there is an answer given in the Vedic lore which are understood, it is Vedvad. So Vedvad means is the philosophy and Mimamsa that you must engage in ritualistic works. Why? Because they are works which will lead you towards joining with God or realizing moksha. So it's work you must do. You must do ritualistic sacrifices. There again the question is, if you do ritualistic sacrifices with the idea of desire for earthly good, then again it's a desire. So Shri Krishna refutes that right away. Not that you cannot do it, but you must know it will remain, continue to be a bondage. So people who believe they are doing ritualistic sacrifices, sacrifice word he'll come to a little later, but who are doing ritualistic sacrifices, they are very religious, and therefore they become adhikari of the highest good. No. They are still bound by works, because their turning to God is for very personal purposes, for satisfying their ego and desire. That's why the mother has raised the bar of this yoga. Give yourself for the joy of giving. The moment there is demand, it's not that, again, mithyachari is, I will not outwardly express demand, but inside my mind is indulging. So she says, if your mind is indulging, say it. Don't indulge in mithyachar, but you must know the direction in which we must stand. So that's where Shri Krishna explains that there is a Vedic understanding, and then some people say that whatever are the mechanical works that you have to engage in, bathing and eating, you will continue. But here Shri Krishna is asking him to engage in battle. Again Arjun says, okay, I can do works as the Vedvadins. I'll wear a akar robe and I'll go and do all the puja, arti, homam. Is that okay? Keshav, Madhav says no. You have to fight the battle. Now comes a problem. How can I fight the battle? I have no desire for victory. I have no desire for family anymore. It's a ghor karma. I don't want to fight. So there he says, he reveals a great truth. In this chapter, he only touches upon it. And there he brings in the element of sacrifice. Sacrifice means my good, my family good. Normal, ordinary people act because of that. But you must act for carrying the march of civilization together towards the great goal. And that's the logic Shri Krishna gives why he is acting in the world. And therein comes the principle of sacrifice. So this is a word he will use, yagya. So again, sacrifice evokes different meanings. As I said, meanings are a big problem. The crudest way of sacrifice was practiced in very primitive cultures, which was human sacrifice, narbali. And the whole purpose of this was, and it was only a very healthy, strong young man who was sacrificed. If he had a defect, he couldn't be sacrificed. And this was very primitive age, and it was to remind the society that society is greater than any individual, however strong he may be. What a way to remind. But this was practiced. Then its modified version was animal sacrifice. Is sacrifice the goat in the name of God? Sacrifice the what is that? Bhaisa, buffalo in the name of God. God is not pleased by all these things. But this is again primitive and crude. Crude communities, crude societies practice it. Then comes the next level of sacrifice, where it sacrifices something which is dear to you. So people find a shortcut. They go to Tirupati and sacrifice their hair. That hair are very dear to me because I look smart and I am sacrificed, knowing very well they are going to grow up. All these are crude and vulgar notions of sacrifice. Some people say, I will sacrifice, I will not eat my favorite food or food for half a day or one day. So Shivinda says these are all vulgar notions of sacrifice. Why? Because they are crude. Some people even start sleeping on a bed of nails, anchorite bed of nail. They give up the pillow and the proper bed. They start sleeping on floor. They give various kinds of pain to their body. And he says that is immolation, that is not sacrifice. Some people blow themselves up, crudest of all, that I am sacrificing myself to the cause of God. Now these are all very crude and vulgar notions of sacrifice. And they don't have spiritual value. They have some value is there of every sacrifice, but they don't have. So what is the original sacrifice? It comes from the first yajna ever conducted in this universe, is before the universe is born. And Shri Krishna reminds that hints at that the one Purusha, the Supreme Lord, he sacrificed himself to become this universe. And that's how Shubhendu used the word, it's much more the sacrifice of the Divine Mother. What is meant by that? Everything of her became this universe. Something of her power has gone into this creation, every element of creation. So meaning thereby, no more I am living only for myself, but for the humanity, for world, and ultimately for God. So when we do it like that, then it is something which is like a semblance of sacrifice for the greater good of all. This is one part. Second aspect of sacrifice is that it is purification. Anything which is given in the fire of aspiration, then it feeds the fire grows higher. So there is a purification which takes place of whatever tendency we have. Because when we live only for gross, crude purposes, then very evidently that tendency continues to remain crude. And when we do it for a greater good, it automatically begins to become better and better and more refined. Third idea of sacrifice was, I sacrifice to the gods and gods will give me this fruit. This of course he says, Sri Krishna says, it will only keep you bound. Because after a while, whether you go to that paradise or you have fruits here, they will be exhausted. So the greatest of all sacrifices, when you know that you are not the doer, the Lord is the doer, and it is not the person to whom you are giving, but to the Lord in that person. That is the greatest sacrifice. What it means practically, when I work, it is not that I am working for the mother. The Divine Mother is giving me the energy, the power, the understanding. And I am working, and this energy, power, everything that she gives me, knowledge, is going to the mother. And this body, this mind is only a channel and an instrument. That is the greatest sacrifice. In practical level also, in human relationship, it means I don't love you. Well, don't say this because people won't understand. But the divine within me loves the divine in you, and this is only a channel. And people have been brought. And it will bring so much, even practically I've seen, the only way to have harmony in human relationship is this. Any other thing, if it is I love you, tomorrow it will be you don't love me enough. Tomorrow it will be I love you, what about you? How much are you loving me? And then there will be all kinds of confusion. But if it is the divine within me who loves you, or loves the divine within you, there is no confusion. Because even if outwardly the person does not respond, you know that the divine has received the love. So Sri Aurobindo says, in all your giving and getting, you must know that it is the divine who is the giver and divine who is the recipient. So when something is given through you, you don't feel that the person should be obliged to you, and you are not puffed up with the idea that I am giving, there should be this return, this reward. Equally, when you are receiving something, you know that divine is the giver. So you are not bound, oh, this person has given me so much, therefore I must give him this much. Whatever the person has given is not to you. You are a trustee. Your only job is to see how you use it. If you use it for purely personal purposes, then you are a thief. So that's the term which the Gita says. Gita uses the word, those who live only for their selfish gains. And it says very interestingly, it says, those who cook the meal only for themselves and only for their own enjoyment, they are thieves. And those who share it with others and they eat the leftover. Here, leftover means whatever is left. This was there in Indian culture at one point of time. I've grown up in that kind of atmosphere at home, that you first give to all these creatures, you offer it to God. Even now I know some families, they'll first offer to God. But then, yes, the family takes. But they would, if somebody has come home, that person becomes the first recipient of the meal. And the last person to have was the lady who has cooked. And people thought that this is atyachar. This is not atyachar. This is greatness. She has cooked the meal, but she waits so that others, first they should be full. That is the meaning of Draupadi's Akshayapatra. So people say, oh, Akshayapatra means endlessly food will come. But look at the hint in the story. Draupadi had received the Akshayapatra. Akshayapatra is, you can make any amount of dishes out of it, any amount of food. But on one condition, you will be the last to eat. When you have eaten, then the Akshayapatra stops functioning. So as the story goes, that once Durvasa Rishi declared that they are going to come, and it's a very interesting story when they are in the forest, the Pandavas along with Draupadi, and Duryodhan, just to tease them, he sent Durvasa with all his 20 odd people retinue to have meal there, because they say Draupadi's Akshayapatra is wonderful. And as it happens, when they declare we are going to come, we are just taking a bath and we'll come back, Draupadi, we are awaiting the delicious meal from your Akshayapatra. So you can't say no to Durvasa, because he is quick to curse. Now she is in a dilemma, because she has finished the food. Now when she has finished the food, it cannot, for that day you can't have more meal. So as always, Sri Krishna comes and he says, I'm hungry, give me something. She says, I'm sorry, already there is Durvasa on my head. Now you have come to tease me, this is not done, brother. You are just already I am worried. If you can't do nothing, at least sit quietly. Let me see what I can do. He says, no, I am hungry. So he goes into that, looks into that bowl very carefully. He says, oh, I can see a grain of rice. You are saying there is nothing. So he says, it's just a grain of rice. So he takes that grain of rice and he says, I offer it to the Brahman, to the Supreme within me. As he offers, all the rishis feel very full. So, occult action. Now they are in a dilemma that if we go back, we are already full, we can't eat more. And if we go back and Draupadi has prepared all the delicious meals, she may get angry and she may say something, and it's not good deed to, you know, throw away food. So they run away. Now this story is very interesting. Draupadi eating last is the clue. So when the person who makes food, prepares food, is the last to partake it, it brings prosperity. When we get things at home and we give it and I'm the last to have it, then it brings prosperity. Which is so different from I'll take out whatever I need or want or desire. Maybe I'll give it to whatever is left over to God. That's why Sri Aurobindo says in his letter, up till now I have lived my life like a thief. I keep 14 annas and keep 2 annas for God. So 16 anna made 1 rupee in those days. 16 anna plus 4 paises. So he says, I have been keeping 14 annas to myself. But see how he was practicing this yoga in his own way. He kept the money in the tray. Quite a good amount of money. 700 plus rupees those days. And whichever servant needed something, he would pick up and spend it. And Shubhindu said, see, it's a sign that people are honest. Now people say, oh, Shubhindu must have definitely kept account. It's not about keeping account. He was communicating something very deep. Whatever he needed, that was provided by God. That is the spirit. It's not like we have to keep the money open. It's not meant. Now that money, in ashram, it is not kept like that. Why? Because now it belongs to the divine. So you spend it divinely. But if you see, even when Sri Aurobindo is in Pondicherry, they would cook the meals, everything. Sri Aurobindo would be the last to take it. Sometimes he would look at the meal, bless it, and everybody takes it as a prasad. That was on his darshan days, on his birthdays. And for everything, when people would, there was one towel and everybody would go for a bath and use it, Sri Aurobindo would be the last to use it. Now all this is the spirit of the Gita, which is so different from the foodie culture where I rush onto food and I eat, when nothing is left for others. So this is how Gita describes, and then it describes yagya in the largest sense, after which we'll read. It says that, well, how is food grain comes into existence? And I'll put it in that great truth in the form of a little story interaction with a group of children. So I asked, what did you eat today? So idli. So where did idli come from? Mama made it. Mama made it, but where did it come from? Oh, rice. So where did rice come from? From the grocery shop. Where did rice come to the grocery shop? From the farm. And where did it come from in the farm? Now a child remarked, oh, That means in a grain of rice, the whole creation is involved. Because there is the seed, there is the sun, there is the water, there is the soil. If you don't have these things, no farmer can grow rice. Then the farmer's labor has gone. Then somebody has carried it to the shop. Then the shop owner has kept it. Then the money you buy, then cooked. So entire cosmos operates. That's what Gita says in a different way. It says, well, from the waters grain comes. So people, from sacrifice, the rains pour. From rains, the grains come. Puts it like that. And then the grain brings food. And those who take this food that is only meant for me are selfish thieves. Now this food applies to everything that we receive in life. Tall order. So Gita is not as simple as it is. Very simple, but not simply I am doing nishkam karma. That spirit is so important. So we have works and sacrifice. And the highest sense, when sacrifice is done like this, when we live life, works are done as a sacrifice, then we really evolve towards the divine. Otherwise, it's all simply a meaningless talk. So we'll just read some chapters, some passages. Page 107. When he explains what is meant by renunciation of works, karma sannyas, he'll elaborate subsequently in the next chapter, is not leaving the works, it's doing works in an unattached manner. So this is the first step we have to practice. Unattached manner, page 107. Or rather 106, last part I'll start. But at least it must be one necessary means. Indispensable. Why? Because a little above we see that and not cessation of the works of Prakriti is what is really meant by the soul's Naishkarmya. So Naishkarmya is the inner state. It's not something outwardly. Not by abstention from works does a man enjoy actionlessness, nor by mere renunciation of works does he attain to his perfection. By not outwardly abstaining, you can attain perfection. Naishkarmya is a state where you are engaged in works, unattached to the works, and you are simply knowing very well the divine is the doer and the action is done, it flows. So first thing he reminds us, such an action leads to siddhi, perfection. But at least it must be one necessary means, indispensable, imperative. For how, if the works of Prakriti continue, can the soul help being involved in them? So the problem is, it's very good to hear it. But when action is taking place, you flow into it. You get attached. Very practical. The ego will get attached. Desire will get attached. It will start by saying no desire. But when it sees somebody else is being recognized and not me, then it says, see, partiality is taking place. The only thing that a divine worker wants is closeness to God. That's his reward. He gets in abundance. But that's why all this hypocrisy begins to come to the surface. People who start complaining, see, I came to Auroville, to ashram, I've been, you know, working right from beginning, see what happened to me. Hari, did you come to get recognition that your will should be done? You came because the divine will should be done. How that will be done? That leave it to the divine. You have done your bit. That's your yoga. When in Bangalore there was a bhavan which was palace gifted by Nepal Maharaja. So as a secretary, when I was asked to take care of the palace, palace means Sri Aurobindo bhavan. So the big challenge was relics were supposed to come because Dhuman Bhai had given a date and time was very short. Then I saw everywhere Maharaja's photographs. I removed them all. Even one of the devotees' photograph from ashram is all removed. Only Mother Sri Aurobindo's photograph. So people complained to him. He came. He came because people said all your photographs. They were jealous. So he asked me. He said, oh, nice. But there were some photographs of my family. I said, yes, I have kept them safe. If you want, I'll give it to you. No, but he didn't know what to say. He has given, but they gave yes. I said, yes, I know that. It's there in the documented. What of them who gave? I said, they've got their reward. They've got the joy of offering to God. And obviously they've been blessed by the mother. If you put photographs, that blessing will make no meaning, because then that blessing is withdrawn. Then he got perplexed. He said, no, he wants the blessings. I said, you decide. You want ego satisfaction? I didn't use the word ego satisfaction. You want the photographs or the blessing? I said, in any case, as long as I am here, I am not going to put them. Because this place is dedicated only to Mother and Sri Aurobindo. So I gave him the example. Even the devotee's photograph I have removed. And I said, he would be very happy. That Navjatji, Bhaiji's photograph. I said, he would be happy. This is dedicated only to Mother and Sri Aurobindo. He quietly went away. I handed him over the parcel of all his photographs. So you see, we have to understand one thing. As one of my friends says, only mother, no other. So he says this, that, you know, that's how the action has to be done. So Prakriti will, and we'll get involved. How can I fight and yet in my soul not think or feel that I, the individual, am fighting, not desire victory, nor be inwardly touched by defeat? This is the teaching of the Sankhyas. So Sri Aurobindo says, therefore, few lines below, page 107, therefore the giving up of life and works is a necessary part. Sankhya teaches that, because otherwise you will get involved, but only a part. An inevitable circumstance and an indispensable last means of the movement to liberation. This objection of a current logic, it is not expressed by Arjun, but it is in his mind, as the turn of his subsequent utterances shows. The teacher immediately anticipates. He says, you are telling Sankhya, Buddhi, separate, detach, and you are asking me to act. So the teacher has understood. So he says something very beautiful. For none stands even for a moment not doing work. Everyone is made to do action helplessly by the modes born of Prakriti. So he says, don't give me this logic, Arjun, that therefore I will not act. You will act. You will be there fretting and fuming, angry to see your own brothers getting killed, because you are attached. As long as you are attached, even if you are physically abstaining, you are still acting. Secret is detachment. And you cannot get detached till you attach to something greater. Otherwise, there is this tendency to get. That's why Mother has given that lovely flowers, orchid, attachment with the divine. And see how long it lasts. One of the flowers which lasts perhaps the longest. Attachment, it needs very little water. Attachment with the divine. Because when you are attached to the divine, all other attachments drop away. So this is the secret that Sri Krishna is taking him slowly towards. Paragraph below. Our physical life, its maintenance, its continuance is a journey, a pilgrimage of the body, sharira yatra, and that cannot be affected without action. He says you have to act. There are things which are basically necessary for the maintenance of the body. But even if a man could leave his body unmaintained, OTOs, if he could stand still always like a tree or sit inert like a stone, there are yogis who try to do that. Tishthati, that vegetable or material immobility would not save him from the hands of nature. He would not be liberated from our workings. As, you know, Shubhinda says, a pebble lying on the shore is acting, having its own effect on the hemispheres. It is a force. A force lying inert is still exerting force. So he says that no inaction by karma. Okay, for it is not our physical movement and activities alone which are meant by works. By karma, our mental existence also is a great complex action. It is even the greater and more important part of the works of the unresting energy, subjective cause and determinant of the physical. We have gained nothing if we repress the effect, but retain the activity of the subjective sense. And then few lines below he says, such a man has bewildered himself with false notions of self-discipline. So this is the important part. That's why if you see some of these Indian stories, when the king judges, it's there even in the Western context. King Solomon, when you see his judgment, Vikram and Vetal stories, Vikramaditya. So in those stories, you see that the judgment is not based on action. It is based on understanding the entire inner field of action. So in Indian thought, the motive is far more important than the outer act. So that's why you can engage in war, provided you have the motive. You may take to sannyas, but your motive may be a selfish liberation. So that's how Indian psychology or dharma works. Dharma is a lot about your thoughts, feelings, motives. Action is important, but the last part. So ahimsa is an inner state. Buddha is in ahimsa, but Gandhi is in mithyachar. Because he is prone to anger. He is prone to, he is very rigid in his, he wants his ideas and opinions to be forced upon people. So he is indulging in a mithyachar, what is called as hypocrisy, which precisely what the Gita cautions us against. And even if he could do it, he engaged others into mithyachar, get beaten by the sticks. That's foolish. Whereas Buddha is practicing ahimsa. He doesn't get perturbed. Yet Buddha has the power. If once he acts, you see, Bamiyan Buddha is just a statue of Buddha. And the day the Talibanis destroyed it, I had written an article that time that what's going to come on Afghanistan, we don't know. Within 6 months, planes came all across from America. And there was the occupation of Taliban for 20 long years. I don't think they have learned the lesson. They just now, they learned but under strange circumstances. Now that hollow of Bamiyan Buddha, they have turned into a tourist site. Because they need money. The same Buddha whom they destroyed, they have said, this is a tourist site, our ancient civilization. It's a fact. So, you know, people are coming and they take to the tourist site because they want money. See the power of Buddha by his immobility. That's why India didn't get independence because of Gandhi. We all know that. That time, 46, 47, many countries got independence who were under the imperial rule because the situation and circumstances were such. But Gandhi was quick to take the credit. But that's a different story. We need not get into it. But that is an example of mithyachar. That inwardly I am harboring everything, but outwardly I am acting as if. Whereas when we see Sri Aurobindo, he speaks about the British, everything openly. But he says there is no hatred inside him. He never said these kind of petty killings are a good thing to do. Not once. And when there is a chance that, well, there's one side the Britishers and other side the Axis powers, he puts his force with the Britishers. He says, I have nothing against British. I want India's freedom and independence. But right now, the civilization is at stake. So if there is one example of that complete nishkam karma, we see Sri Aurobindo in the true karma yoga sense. So all this he explains, and then he says how we should do action. We have already spoken about it, that the mind must bring the senses under its control as an instrument of the intelligent will, and then the organs of action must be used for the proper office, for action, but for action done as yoga. But what is the essence of this self-control? What is meant by action done as yoga, karma yoga? It is non-attachment. That's where nishkam karma and all these come in. It is to do works without clinging with the mind to the objects of sense and the fruit of the works. You should not even remember what you have done. Not complete inaction, which is an error, a confusion, a self-delusion, an impossibility, as explained earlier, but action full and free, done without subjection to sense and passion, desireless and unattached works are the first secret of perfection. First, not the last. Last is doing it completely one with the divine. Do action thus self-controlled, says Krishna. Niyatam kuru karmatvam. Whatever action is given to you, falls within your field, do it this way. Let it become a worship, a hymn, a sacrifice to the divine, a joyous, glad sacrifice. So this is how he says that one becomes free inwardly, and with freedom comes peace and strength and everything. Then, but still there is an essential difficulty unsolved. On page 109 below. Desire is the ordinary motive of all human actions. And if the soul is free from desire, then there is no further rationale for action. This is what we are speaking about. That then why should we act? So the Vedas said that you should act, the ritual works, you should act. Or you should, just the bare minimum required. That's how sannyasis interpret it. But what Sri Aurobindo and Sri Krishna has to say? Page 110, just one line we'll read from the passage which is beginning. The difficulty is this, how our nature, being what it is, and desire the common principle of its action, is it possible to initiate a really desireless action? There won't be an initiating impulse. There has to be an initiating impulse. Desire pushes us. This he will develop in the subsequent chapters also. The mother would say very simply, act under impulsion of the divine will. That's it. But the Gita will develop it over a period of time. Page 111. We cannot become impersonal by obeying something outside ourselves. Meaning thereby, he says, we cannot become impersonal just because I say I will not act for myself, but for my parents, my brother, my sister, my country. That doesn't make us impersonal. It only enlarges the scope of the ego. So, we can only do it by rising to the highest in ourselves, into our free soul and self. So, impersonal selflessness, sometimes one may be selfless with regard to oneself, but yet live for others. Society, humanity, family, ideals, opinions. The only way to impersonality is to live for the divine in oneself and divine in the world. So this is what he is describing, and that's where the doctrine of sacrifice steps in. By doing works otherwise than for sacrifice. Page 111, inverted commas. The divine teacher says, by doing works otherwise than for sacrifice, this world of men is in bondage to works. For sacrifice, practice works. O son of Kunti, becoming free from all attachment. So you see how difficult it is to practice. Even the Pandit who goes to do Katha, he says Hari Katha, Gita Path, he is waiting. After the Katha, what am I going to get? And there are some smart Pandits who say, please don't give me check, because ED raid aa jayega. Give me cash or give me kind. I know people who say this. Not only Pandits, all over. And it need not always, maybe name, fame, 100 things. All these means you are still living in a state of bondage. Not in a state of inner freedom. And a person who is himself not free cannot help anybody get free. So, the moment you have these motives, even attachment to a religion, you have that motive that I must influence others to follow this religion because my name will be registered in the book of God. So all these motives must go. So we have this last line on page 111. Egoism is the knot of the bondage. By acting Godwards without any thought of ego, we loosen this knot and finally arrive at freedom. And this applies to cults and sects so much, which proselytize. That, you know, I am doing it in the name of Christ. I am doing it in the name of Allah. I am doing it in the name of Krishna. So even there, we don't know what his will is. That's the aim. And his will is not a fixed standard formula. You may think that, you know, Krishna wants everybody to be converted or Christ wants everybody to be converted. And I am leaving aside the Allah part. But frankly speaking, do we really believe that? That they want to just expand an outer empire when men's hearts are full of, you know, malice and ill will. So that's why people don't understand when Sri Aurobindo says, I don't want hundreds and thousands of people to join. So page 112, We spoke about Vedism and the Vedanta already. So he says that there are people who do the rituals, sacrifice, but they do it to fulfill their desires either in this world or a seat in paradise. But they must know that no paradise is permanent. Only God is permanent. Either they will be thrown out of the paradise when the term is over, or anyways you have to come out. You can't stay in paradise forever. And when you come back, you have to again get into the cycle of ignorance. Therefore, fools seek paradise. And what a paradise. Sometimes you wonder, is it paradise or hell? Paradise where all your repressed desires upon earth are satisfied. Multiplied by 72 times or God knows how many times. Your sexual desires, your this desire. What? I just can't understand how foolish humanity can be that it believes in it and follows it. So paradise there and paradise, all the riches that you want, and then you'll be kicked out of that paradise. Today or tomorrow you'll be there. The Gita, finally, page 112, last passage. The Gita resolves this opposition by insisting that the Devas are only forms of the one Deva, the Ishwara, the Lord of all yoga and worship and sacrifice and austerity. And if it is true that sacrifice offered to the Devas leads only to material results and to paradise, it is also true that sacrifice offered to the Ishwara leads beyond them to the great liberation. So when you do it to the gods, you are bound, because gods have a, they will give you material results, either success, money and all that. But that means you are still bound. But when you do it to the Supreme, then they will liberate you, which is the greatest good. All works in their totality find their culmination and completeness in the knowledge of the Divine. Sarvam karma akhilam partha jnane parisamapyate. All works that lead us to closeness with the Divine. There they end. They are not an obstacle, but the way to the Supreme Knowledge. If you do the works dedicating to the Divine, sacrifice to the Divine. Thus, this opposition too is reconciled with the help of a large elucidation of the meaning of sacrifice. In fact, its conflict is only a restricted form of the larger opposition between yoga and Sankhya. Vedism is a specialized and narrow form of yoga. The principle of the Vedantist is identical with that of the Sankhyas. For to both, the movement of salvation is the recoil of the intelligence, the buddhi, from the differentiation powers of nature, from ego, mind, senses, from the subjective and the objective. Subjective is the inner world of thoughts, feelings, etc. And the objective is the sense-bound reality. It is with this object of reconciliation in his mind that the teacher first approaches his statement of the doctrine of sacrifice. But throughout, even from the very beginning, he keeps his eyes not on the restricted Vedic sense of sacrifice and works, but on their larger and universal application. That widening of narrow and formal notions to admit the great general truths they unduly restrict, which is always the method of the Gita. So he starts speaking of the truth. He's talking of the method. He's not cancelling. No, no, don't do this. Do this. He doesn't do that. That is the beauty of the teaching. And he gives us a hint of what a true teacher should do. Gita says, this is this. This will get you this. This is how. But you can enlarge the scope. If you desire objects of the senses, you will experience joy and sorrow. If you restrain the senses, but the mind is indulging, you are doing hypocrisy. If your mind is controlling, what is the mechanism? The buddhi. But buddhi alone is not sufficient. Do it for the sake of the greatest good. So this is how it gives us a complete picture and leaves us at the end free to choose. So, like the perfect teacher who tells us what is action, what are the results of this, and now he leaves us free to make a choice. To make our choices. Thank you.